But we recognized pretty early on that a lot of work needed to get done on the protocol side of things in Bitcoin. And we felt by 2015 that it wasn't going to get done, really. And it would be up to application developers to do whatever they could to enhance user privacy. So Samurai was built and born from a desire to give users the most private on-chain experience.
I live unbanked off of cryptocurrency, and I use BitRefill extensively because it lets me pay with crypto at places that don't yet accept it directly. This one service, more than any other, helps me live on crypto, pay your prepaid phone bill, or buy gift cards to thousands of major retailers around the world, all with cryptocurrency, including for exact amounts so you don't have to buy more gift credit than you need for a specific purchase. You can use BitRefill without an account, but if you get an account, you can earn rewards points, which translate to savings, and you can also hold a balance denominated in dollars or euros to protect yourself against market crashes. Go to bitrefill.com, click Create Account, and enter the referral code DCN, or follow the link in the description.
So, hey everyone, I have the wonderful pleasure of speaking with the one and only Samurai of Samurai Wallet. How's it going?
Hey there, thanks for having me. Doing good.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming on, and it's kind of interesting because the crypto world has evolved as far as privacy is concerned a whole lot. More importantly, like the perceptions of that have evolved in the early days when people just started to use Bitcoin. Before even HD wallets, people just thought, oh, it's anonymous. No one can see what I'm doing. And then eventually it was like, well, you know, you can kind of trace some stuff, but it's still okay. And then they're like, well, if you just use like CoinJoin or Mixing or privacy coins, whatever definition that might encompass, then you're okay. And then today we're starting to see some actors who have employed various obfuscation tactics, including CoinJoin, that have ended up being de-anonymized in the end. In this case, criminals, I believe, the Bitfinex hacker and then the DAO hacker have both employed
Twitter some hacker as well.
Yes. And so basically, this takes us to an interesting spot where a lot of people who aren't really deep in the weeds like you are, a lot of people don't know if they can trust privacy on cryptocurrency anymore. Especially with on-chain privacy, especially with a transparent chain such as Bitcoin. So first, you just really quickly want to break down who you are. I mean, obviously not who you are, but you know what I'm saying. What you do and what Samurai is and stuff.
Sure, absolutely. So Samurai Wallet was started in early 2015 by myself and my co-founder, TDevD. It was just the two of us. We had been working and living fully on Bitcoin for about 3 years when we decided to build Samurai Wallet. And it's funny, as you mentioned in your intro, the progression of people's perceptions of privacy on Bitcoin. We knew pretty early on that privacy on Bitcoin was pretty low. The issue wasn't a massive deal yet because at that time there were no real KYC exchanges. So the attribution from of your physical real life identity to your Bitcoins was not really established yet like it is today. Because of the massive use of centralized KYC exchanges. So it was still synonymous, really. So it wasn't that we didn't feel like it needed to be addressed. It was that the way Satoshi had designed it as a pseudonymous system was okay for now. But we recognized pretty early on that a lot of work needed to get done on the protocol side of things in Bitcoin. And we felt by 2015 that it wasn't going to get done, really. And it would be up to application developers to do whatever they could to enhance user privacy. So Samurai was built and born from a desire to give users the most private on-chain experience. So the most private experience when using the Bitcoin blockchain, layer one.
Yeah, so real quick, how does one usually, other than obviously using KYC services, which is very obvious, I would say, how does one usually compromise one's privacy when using Bitcoin? And what tools does Samurai use to kind of help fix that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it can be very basic. So on the more basic side of things, address reuse is a major privacy mistake that many people make. And this is usually due to wallet developers who don't take this into account. So every time you open your wallet up, and you should get a new Bitcoin address. Every time you click the receive screen, you should get a new Bitcoin address to give to people. If you're not doing that, you're giving away a massive amount of information about your total wallet state, including balance and prior and future transactions. So that's a very basic one. All HD wallets give you a new Bitcoin address. So on the a little bit more esoteric, but still quite basic, is how your Bitcoin wallet organizes the change output of your transaction. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if your listeners understand the concept of change in a Bitcoin transaction, but you know, imagine you buy a pack of gum for a dollar, for 50 cents, you give them a dollar bill and you get 50 cents back, right? So Bitcoin kind of works the same way with its UTXO model. In the transaction, yeah, you get change back. Most wallets will put the change in a deterministic position, so it'll always be, you know, the last output of the transaction or the first output of the transaction. So that's not a serious privacy threat by itself, but it's a heuristic that can be used in conjunction with other information that could work to de-anonymize you. Samurai wallet randomizes the change output. Continuing on the change output, in Bitcoin, there's different address types. So some addresses begin with one, some addresses begin with three, and some addresses begin with a B, right? For the latest addresses, batch 32. If you are sending, your wallet is a batch 32 wallet, so your wallet address begins with B, yeah, and you're sending to an address that begins with one, most wallets will return the change back to address beginning with B. And that will give someone looking a pretty reliable indicator that the address with one is the place you were spending, the external place, and the address with B is your change output. So they can continue tracking you via that change output. Mm-hmm. Samurai wallet will match the address type. So if you're spending to address with one, the change will come back to an address with one. It'll still be in your wallet, but if you're looking externally on the blockchain, now there's a question mark as to which is the change output and which is the destination. So, you know, those are the basics that a wallet can do automatically on behalf of their users. There's certain things that users need to do or can do, but they need to invoke the action. That can be your stuff like CoinJoin. Mm-hmm. Advanced transactions like in Samurai, we have the ability to do actual coin joins, but without a coordinator, without someone coordinating it, like Samurai. Mm-hmm. You can do that peer-to-peer. These undermine, you know, fundamental analysis heuristics, where, you know, for one, you can assume that from all the inputs, all the Bitcoin that are used to send some to an external place are owned by the same person, right? So you can say if you're sending one Bitcoin and it's composed of two 0.5 UTXOs, that the same person owns those two UTXOs, those two, yeah, outputs. These peer-to-peer coin join transactions breaks that assumption because two participants are contributing UTXOs to make one transaction. So you introduce DAO into the transaction graph.
Yeah, so we were talking about the change address. So automatically when you, in most wallets, I would say, when, let's just say you start with like a one Bitcoin chunk and then you send it somewhere, you're usually not going to spend the entire thing in one go, and then you get the rest back in change. Right. And over time, you might have different, obviously, different chunks and different change addresses. And what a lot of wallets do is then combine these together, kind of like, you know, if you get change from multiple cash transactions, then you'll use those all together in a purchase at some point in the future. It's so... that's pretty harmful for privacy, is that right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. For anyone looking on the blockchain, you are creating what we call deterministic links when you make these transactions that combine inputs, is what we call it, right? So you're combining the transaction you got from your pastor when you made a donation to your church, and you're combining the output that you use to, pay a cam girl, right? So you have these two interminglings that in real life, you wouldn't want to do, right? You wouldn't want to intermingle those two things. With Bitcoin by default, the way Bitcoin's designed, you know, you can merge these two things together and it's publicly available on the blockchain.
So from just a practical perspective, at some point with enough usage, you're going to have a whole lot of change lying around and you might have a use for it, like a payment you need to make, but you don't want to combine those for privacy reasons. So what is typically done there for someone who's privacy conscious in order to make a payment? If you cannot really combine inputs and one of those chunks is too small to complete a desired payment.
Right. So usually what at this point a user decides that this is where they need to perform some type of coin join transaction, right? Because the whole point of a coin join is to disassociate the past history of a UTXO with its future activity. So you want to break a link there. So if it's large enough, if the amount of the Bitcoin is large enough to enter into a coin join, a coordinated coin join, which in Samurai Wallet is called Whirlpool, that minimum output amount is 0.001 Bitcoin. So roughly about $50 worth of Bitcoin. They would enter that coordinated coin join, and that would provide them the best protection, right, from associating any past activity. That would provide them no deterministic links, anonymity set, and the ability to continue to gain anonymity set on that amount. If they don't have at least 0.001 Bitcoin, they could engage in a peer-to-peer coin join with a friend of theirs or someone they know, or they go online and find someone who wants to do this with them. And when they go to spend that amount, it's involved in one of these peer-to-peer coin joins. And these can be really any amount. And the good thing about these peer-to-peer coin joins is it allows you to combine the Bitcoin, as we discussed, in normal circumstances you don't want to do. It allows you to do it in such a way that it creates a transaction with a large amount of entropy. And when you're dealing with a public blockchain, everything is on the blockchain, right? Because we're not a Lightning wallet. We deal with layer one. The name of the game is creating large amounts of doubt, so that if you're analyzing the blockchain, you're doing an investigation, you reach a certain point where the probabilities start to grow exponentially, And the larger the amount of probabilities, the less accurate your analysis is going to be.
Yeah. So what is, really quick, what is the difference between a coordinated and uncoordinated coin join?
Sure. So a coordinated coin join is in Samurai Wallet called Whirlpool. Other implementations are like Wasabi Wallet is another type of coordinated coin join. And what we mean by that is that there's a central coordinator that's blinded. So what this coordinator does is it accepts signed transactions, for example, and proofs of owning a certain amount of Bitcoin or this Bitcoin in a blinded way, so it doesn't know what it's taking, and composes a transaction in Whirlpool's case with 5 inputs and 5 outputs. That means 5 different participants, 5 different wallets in that one transaction. And we use a centralized coordinator to do that because it's quite difficult to, deal with 5 different clients in a peer-to-peer manner when dealing with collecting signed transactions and stuff. So the coordinator makes it easier to increase the amount of participants. Let's just put it that way. And one of the benefits of this is the coordinator has the ability to, stop certain actions that would undermine and make the coin join weaker. So it can have, a set of rules like no address reuse in the mix, no coins that have been mixed together previously can be in the same mix. All these kind of cool little neat rules that the coordinator can enforce. Uncoordinated coin join is 2 participants, you and another person. So your anonymity set is a smaller amount, but you're able to do a coin join together. There's a couple different types, but this assumption is you're sending an external third party service some amount. As you're doing that, you're combining multiple inputs from your wallet and their wallet into one transaction. They're not paying for it. They're only paying half the miner fee, but they're able to consolidate their inputs into larger amounts. And the way the transaction is composed, there's at least 1.5 bits of entropy, meaning I don't remember the exact number of combinations, but there's a large number of combinations as to which input owns which output. So it's essentially a weaker form of the coordinated coin join. Ideally, they work together, but they can each work independently as well.
Yeah, so it sounds like the coordinated coin join is much more robust on, I guess, almost every level. But it's because it's coordinated, it's sometimes, I guess, more difficult or expensive to do. And some people might just seek to do peer-to-peer.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So the coordinator has to charge a coordinator fee. It's the most important thing they do that is to stop what we call Sybil attacks. So making it basically free to flood the coordinator with and take over and be the majority amount of coins in the coordinator, that are involved in the coin join. So to avoid that type of attack, there's a coordinator fee and various other incentives to avoid that type of behavior, because that's one of the ways to attack a coin join client.
Yeah, so this has been, from a lot of people's estimation, seems like a lot of early dark web kind of users were big into coin join for obvious reasons, and most people didn't even know this existed from the average Bitcoin user probably. And one thing I've noticed from a few of these hacks in the past, a few like high profile thefts, have, from what I've been able to tell, not included any major privacy protecting actions, like very few coin joins, very few things like that. And so it seemed relative, for anyone who knows basically how cryptocurrencies tend to work, it seemed very kind of like, duh, of course these guys got caught, they're being really stupid. And then the more recent high-profile thefts that were uncovered seem to include some manner of coin join in many of them. Mm-hmm. And yet they were de-anonymized. Obviously, every case is different, but do you have any visibility on generally on why that was and how that was achieved?
Yes. Yeah. So we've been, obviously we have an interest in CoinJoin as, mm-hmm. as a software project. So we've been keeping an eye on the industry as a whole. And each one of the instances that, I mean, you mentioned with the mm-hmm. Bitfinex hacker, the DAO hacker, the Twitter hacker, and Plus Token Ponzi scheme, the Lazarus Group, crime syndicate in North Korea, they all used Wasabi CoinJoin. Mm-hmm. And they all were eventually de-anonymized through this, at least we were able to de-anonymize them using algorithmically, because we identified serious flaws in the Wasabi CoinJoin implementation. Our position is that CoinJoin itself, if implemented properly, is still the strongest method of protection that a user can have on Bitcoin. But if done improperly, can be a serious threat.
And so what were some of these flaws in this implementation?
So the first flaw we noticed, the first thing we noticed actually with mm-hmm. with Wasabi, and this is what got us looking in the first place, and this was in early or mid 2019 is when mm-hmm. we first started looking, was, as I mentioned before on just a minute ago, one way to attack a CoinJoin implementation is through something called a Sybil attack. And we monitor, Whirlpool for any kind of Sybil attack looking behavior. And we noted, we also watched Wasabi at that time. And we noticed indicators that would indicate that a Sybil attack was being was taking place on the Wasabi CoinJoin. Now, this has nothing to do with Wasabi. They aren't the ones sibling themselves. They just hadn't noticed. They hadn't noticed it. And we did notice. So we said something about it. We mentioned it and showed our work, so to speak, on why we believe that's what we were seeing. But in the course of that investigation into that Sybil attack, we noticed a couple serious flaws with Wasabi. And the first and simplest one is address reuse. We noticed two types of address reuse. One where the mixed outputs were reusing that address. So you would have, let's say you had two mixed outputs in the Wasabi mixed transaction. They both went to the same address, right? So that was one type of address reuse we saw, which it was obviously bad because you've now connected unintentionally those two mixed outputs together into as one entity. But it's not as serious because you still can't by itself connect those two outputs to what went in, what address went in. But the second type of address reuse we saw was really quite bad, where the input address matched the output address. So the address that went in to the mix was where the mixed outputs went to. So that was a really, really bad one. And we were very surprised by this because it's very unusual to see the same address on the input and the output side of a transaction.
Yeah.
At least it is in this day and age. Back in the old days, you would see it in the, you only had one address in your wallet, right? But we're way past that point. So we noticed this, and the fundamental composition of a Whirlpool mix and a Samurai, and a Wasabi mix are fundamentally different. Even though it's the same type of coordinated blinded CoinJoin, the rules that the coordinator employ are very, very different. And this is important, so I'm trying to make sure I explain it so your listeners can understand. For one, the number of outputs that you can contribute to a mix transaction is one. Mm-hmm. That means you contribute one output and there's four other wallets or users contributing an output. So it's five in total. The output has to be the outputs that are contributed can't have ever mixed together before. And there has to be at least one output contributed by someone who is what we call remixing. So they've already mixed before and now they're mixing again. That's on the, you know, the input composition side. So they have to be involved. On there can also be no address reuse. Obviously, I mean, that's like such the most basic thing. And the outputs all have to be of a uniform value, right? So they either have to be like 0.01 or 0.001 or 0.05 or 0.5. They have to be uniform. And the reason they have to be uniform, and the reason none of the UTXOs can be seen together, so when you run an entropy analysis on this transaction, even though there's only five inputs and five outputs, the number of combinations between those inputs and outputs is almost 1500 for a single mix. The reason one has to be from at least one has to be from a remixer, someone who's already mixed, is so the anonymity set of all of the outputs can with some amount of probability trace way back to the first mix. So everyone is hiding in a very large crowd. Okay. None of those restrictions exist on Wasabi. And so when you have all of these, what we would call structural issues, meaning you can have many people who have already mixed before be in one mix. You can have many coins in one mix. And there's multiple different amounts in the mix, not uniform. And the change output that we were talking about previously is involved in the mix as well. When you add all of these things together, you're able to attack the mix based on various heuristics. You're able to attack the mix on deterministic links that are inside that mix. Mm-hmm. So just because, you know, they're both coin joined, but they're fundamentally different. And what we were able to do just by starting these investigations into Sybil attack behavior, we discovered this address reuse issue. And then we're able to combine the address reuse issue and the fact that the unmixed change is involved in the mixed transaction. And that's pretty much those two things are pretty much would have quote unquote demixed all of those major attackers that were hackers or criminals that went into Wasabi on the most recent.
Yeah. So for the average, I would say, crypto user who is observing these kinds of things, they probably wouldn't be able to tell very much from that. But someone with a greater knowledge, like an actual like blockchain analytics company, might have a lot more success then in de-anonymizing these transactions, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the blockchain analytics company have, you know, custom built software that they use to analyze the blockchain that makes it real easy for them to see address reuse, makes it real easy for them to see deterministic links. And the software or the websites that most Bitcoin users use don't have those capabilities, right? So this was actually why in 2016 we acquired the software for OXT, which is a blockchain explorer, but actually really a more of a blockchain analysis platform. And it was created by a brilliant Seoul developer and independent researcher, Laurent, who was approached by a chain analysis firm for acquisition And because, you know, he's so fundamentally opposed to, you know, using that kind of information the way it's used as a way to control and, you know, we'll leave it there. He said no yeah. to a very lucrative acquisition. And he, you know, we decided to step in and say, hey, look, we're privacy activists. We do all this work on Bitcoin privacy, but users have no way of being able to counter, you know, the chain analysis opponents. What if we give them that, you know, give them that way? So OXT is a very full featured analysis platform that's available for free online. And it's exactly what we use. It's the only tool we use when we're investigating and looking at our own mixes as well as Wasabi's mixes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. You know, the tools are out there, but it's just about getting users educated and them being interested enough to learn about these kind of you know, shortcomings on in Bitcoin privacy and how they can protect themselves from it.
It's obviously a speculation at this point, but why would you think that in these three high profile cases that the hackers decided to use Wasabi amongst all the tools available to them?
Well, it's the most well marketed in terms of they buy a lot of ad space on YouTube and you know around the internet. They have a lot of volume coming in, so it's the most attractive in terms of you have a large amount you want to try to mix. It looks like there's a large amount of volume coming in, so that's good for you. You'll get mixed quicker. Our investigations have shown that actually a bulk of their volume comes from one custodial mixer, which is a whole other story. But a custodial mixer, the name of it is escaping me right now, in some mixes is 30 to 40% of their volume, right? So that's a little bit of a misnomer there, but these people, they don't know that, right? So they're just looking and they see this. It looks, and most importantly, it's available on desktop natively on Windows, right? So they have a very wide net. And the people, I don't think, know the issues that have been raised, again, since 2019. So these have been known about by us and by our community for quite a long time. So each one of these, it ends up being really the same sequence of events that we're able to analyze and provide research on, but that research isn't hitting a wider, you know, market, let's just say.
Yeah. So, obviously we're talking about blockchain privacy here as far as being able to break transaction graphs and making sure people don't really, they can't follow the transaction on the blockchain to wherever it ends up going, or link identities, etc. Now, how important, even if you keep good on-chain privacy, as it were, how important are other factors? For example, I mean, like KYC obviously is one, and other things such as, you know, IP address and other basically external factors to the actual movements on-chain. Yeah. How important are those? And what are some of the bigger pitfalls that people can fall into with those kinds of elements that kind of might undo some of their hard work that they do with, you know, proper on-chain privacy?
Yeah, well, you know, it works together, right? Like, so the most recent, the DAO hacker, you know, they kind of went wrong at every step of the way, right? Like they used Shapeshift to go into Bitcoin, which, you know, was very easy to spot that transaction. Shapeshift, you know, they have a dedicated compliance position, right? So they're not some sort of a tool that people should be using as a privacy tool. Then they went through Wasabi. Now that it's not their fault what happened the way it was demixed, but it's Wasabi's fault, but they didn't know that. They went through Wasabi. Their transactions were linked. We knew their transaction because of Shapeshift. We knew their mixed outputs because of Wasabi. And from there, they went to a KYC exchange. So, you know, and each step of the way, they kind of messed up there. Now, if they were perfect on on-chain privacy, you know, they still cash out to a KYC exchange. I believe the DAO hacker did an exchange for Grin, and then cashed out to a custom node name of their their name. So you know that was another mistake there. So I think that the moral of the story is one, don't use KYC. Two, keep clear separation of identity, right? Mm-hmm. Like don't do that from a phone that's connected to your Google account or your iOS account. Don't use your home Wi-Fi. Go make sure you're going through Tor. So keeping, I think, a separation would be a good idea, not just for any criminal activity, for all activity, right? Like it's a good idea to have a separate work phone, not a work, doing all your work stuff on your personal phone. It's the same concept. So I think that's a big piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, for sure. Now without the state of on-chain privacy, right? It seems like, as far as the conversation has shifted over the years, of course, it went from, CoinJoin to then any, quote, privacy coins, including coins like Verge, which don't really actually offer any on-chain privacy, all the way to, if it's not private by default, doesn't work or something. And now we get to, of course, the encrypted privacy solutions such as Zcash seem to be kind of at the forefront of the discussion. Do you think that on-chain privacy from a completely transparent blockchain has a long-term future as being sufficient? Because obviously everything is visible on the blockchain. You just sometimes don't know what it means, but it's always going to be a wealth of information in front of people who might want to analyze it. And obviously, if you make a small mistake, it seems like that can kind of undo a whole lot of this. So is on-chain privacy on a completely transparent ledger, such as Bitcoin's, is that a long-term losing battle? Or do you think it's going to be still very viable in the future?
I think it has to be viable. There has to be some form of privacy on the base layer of any, cryptocurrency. In our case, we specifically focus on Bitcoin, and our belief is that Bitcoin's strong network effect and its general size and time it's been around, it's likely to be the market leader in cryptocurrencies for a long time. That makes it all the more important that we figure out privacy on the base layer. Now, anyone who's followed us for any amount of time, we can be pretty critical of core protocol development. We don't feel like the core developers have prioritized privacy for many, many, many years. All these guys work on this open source project, so you can't really dictate what they work on. They just got to work on what they want to work on. So we're not going to, bitch and moan about it. We're going to do what we can. We're not on the protocol side, we're on the application side. And there's many users of the layer one still. The majority of users are on layer one. And some form of privacy must be obtained there. So we'll continue doing this on the application side and proving that there's a big market for it and hoping that in the future we'll see some protocol level developments. But if we don't, at least the application side of things has been developed. If Samurai and the other privacy projects hadn't existed this, you know, all these years, I think Bitcoin would be in a much worse state than it is today.
Yeah. So what improvements on the application side would you like to see in the future? And also, you mentioned the protocol side. What are some changes to the Bitcoin protocol that you think would have a very nice positive effect on privacy?
Sure. It's a difficult one to say on the protocol side. Everything has its trade-offs. I think the most basic privacy improvement and most promising one that we've seen in a long time is signature aggregation. This would make it cheaper, and we'd be able to make even more effective coin join transactions. For whatever reason, it was stripped out of the latest upgrade to Bitcoin, which was called Taproot. And it was ready to go. It had been promised to be part of the Taproot upgrade, and at the last minute, it was stripped out and said, "Oh, we'll put it in later." You know, that was a big, you know, in our opinion, a big loss for users. And the fact that it was stripped out and put on the shelf for later makes it even less likely that that time will come, because these changes, even the most basic changes to the protocol, are always contentious. There's always some group or some entity that wants to do it a different way or doesn't agree. And, you know, so that's by design. You know, changing the protocol should be difficult, right? But when something has consensus and everyone pretty much wants it to be in, and suddenly it gets taken out, that's a big problem.
Yeah, it's a little strange.
Yeah, it was strange. It absolutely was strange. But we've been in the space long enough and have seen the way core developers have ignored privacy and more focused on scaling in the terms of Lightning Network and making changes that benefit Lightning Network. And, you know, if you're like us and don't really believe Lightning Network is the scaling solution that ultimately will be for Bitcoin, it's a kind of a malinvestment, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. As a quick aside, though, on that, if you don't think that Lightning is the scaling solution that will help Bitcoin out, how would you rather see Bitcoin scale?
Well, it's not a question of the exact technical way we would like to see Bitcoin scale. Mm-hmm. It's more the fact that Lightning Network was, as soon as it was proposed, it was kind of crowned the way forward. And that was in around the 2016-2017 blockchain size wars, right? Where we had all these splits and there was contentious between big blocks and small blocks and SegWit or no SegWit and all this kind of stuff. We feel that Lightning was put forward as the winner in response to a perceived need to scale rapidly. And as we've seen, you know, now in the luxury of time, that wasn't required at that point. You know, we didn't go to a point of adoption where scaling to second layers was warranted. And Lightning Network is hardly used today. I mean, it's barely used. Mm-hmm. Everything is still happening on chain for the most part, and fees are, you know, incredibly low. So we feel like if there had been more time and more solutions allowed to develop and compete in that marketplace of ideas, we would have a kind of a better solution. So it's not about us saying this is the way we would have preferred. It's that the Lightning Network is not really well thought out. It's incredibly complex. It's nowhere near close to really being consumer ready. All of these things, even before I even wrap it up, the fact that complexity and that complexity has resulted in an ecosystem of Lightning Network that is mostly centralized, right? The most, mm-hmm. the biggest Lightning wallets are centralized. And that's because to use, you know, Lightning in a non-centralized, non-custodial way is very difficult. You know, running a Lightning node is difficult and with risk, right? You could lose your funds in that Lightning node. Whereas Bitcoin is not complex. You know, it's technical, but the white paper is very understandable, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's an intuitive system. Reading the Lightning Network white paper is not the same as reading the Bitcoin white papers. It's a more technical, complex system. Because of that, it's driven centralization and users into custodial solutions. And none of these things are, I think, good developments.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. Do you think that at some point in the future, a lot of Bitcoin and possibly other cryptocurrencies' preferred privacy method might end up being something along like a sidechain route, where obviously you could still use CoinJoin and things like that for big movements, but most, in order to sort of sever transaction history, people would move to an encrypted sidechain and then back out into Bitcoin at a later point and kind of have a fresh history, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, I could definitely see that. I think sidechains are one of the things that got, ignored really during that Lightning Network scaling period. Drive chains is another one, which is similar to sidechains with different trade-offs. And there's all sorts of smart people with Rootstock, Sergio and Rootstock, he proposed that right at the wrong time because everyone was obsessed again with the block size and it was ignored on core development. That could have been something quite interesting. Yeah. I think it is a definite possibility. One of the things we're looking at in Samurai is atomic swaps. With the Monero blockchain, so being able to sever transaction history on the Bitcoin blockchain by hopping into the Monero blockchain through an atomic swap, and then at some point back into Bitcoin. Whatever direction it goes, the ultimate goal is that, as I said before, that those who wish to use the layer one, the Bitcoin blockchain, are able to do so in a privacy preserving way. You know, there's a huge amount of users that were in the Lightning Network or sidechain or wherever they are, and maybe using the Bitcoin blockchain is expensive, they still have that option, right? The reality that we've seen, of course, even as the Bitcoin has grown and the whole crypto ecosystem has grown, Bitcoin fees have not increased. You know, you can still get into the next block with one Satoshi per byte.
Now, why do you think that is? Because I do remember, I've been using Bitcoin since 2013 on a pretty regular basis, and I definitely remember the fees becoming astronomical with relatively like moderate scaling of the user base. And then it seems like it's just been the last year or two, it's been not very long, when now all of a sudden the percentage of the fee in the block reward, for example, has just been going down even during bull market times. And now you have a lot of people are saying, oh, that's Lightning. Look, everyone's using Lightning.
No, it's not Lightning.
I've ran a Lightning node. I use Lightning extensively, and I'm not seeing that kind of activity on Lightning that I could tell.
No.
So what do you think? What do you think it has been?
Okay, so it's two. There's two things. The fee event of 2014, 2015, and 2016 was a spam attack. Let's just put it that way. I mentioned Laurent of OXT. He did some phenomenal research, all available still today, and discovered what he called the white whale, and it was a coordinated and long-term spam attack on the Bitcoin blockchain to drive fees up. Let me not say spam attack, because it's not spam. If it's paying the fee, it's a transaction like everyone else's. So it was an attack to increase the fee rate for a sustained period of time. Now you can say, well, that must have been this person because they wanted to, increase the demand, perceived demand for scaling the blockchain. Could have been the other party to who, whatever. It doesn't matter. That's the fact is fees rose significantly due to artificial demand for block space. Mm-hmm. Once that ended, fees started to trend downwards. You also had the SegWit increase, which increased block size, in a small way, but still did increase the amount of transactions that could be added to a block. And the second part is, so why have the fees stayed basically the bottom of the market? Like I said, you can get into the next block most days for one Satoshi per byte during a huge adoption wave. Well, my belief is that those people didn't come into Bitcoin. They went into Ethereum and they went into various other cryptocurrencies. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, the second layer that took adoption was not Bitcoin. They moved away from that adoption curve.
Interesting. Now, as far as in Bitcoin itself, is there a possibility that simply a higher percentage of the activity, the economic activity surrounding Bitcoin, meaning number of individuals and amount of capital involved that has been increasing, is it possible that much less of that actually touches the real Bitcoin blockchain? Meaning, for example, exchanges batch a lot of transactions, a lot of exchanges that, or a lot of companies such as, Robinhood and Cash App and things like that, are selling people Bitcoin. And once people buy that Bitcoin, they don't necessarily touch it on chain. Actually, it doesn't actually, they don't actually have control over those keys. And it just did in the past, it was more frequent that new users onboarded would actually receive a Bitcoin transaction, and the transactions would occur much more frequently. Whereas now a lot of that is done off-chain, and not off-chain meaning Lightning, but off-chain meaning centralized exchanges.
I think that's right. I think that's right for the most part. Give me one second. Sorry, I just got distracted.
Yeah, no problem.
I think with when it's kind of difficult because you have just centralized exchanges, right? Let's say your Coinbases and your Geminis and your Binances. You have a relatively decent withdrawal rate from those to self-custody. Mm-hmm. Still, but of course your Robin Hoods, what's the other one? There's the
Cash App, GBC, of course.
Yeah, the Cash PayPal. App. The PayPal. I believe those get far more use and have more users in that kind of space. And I think it goes to a shift again around the 2016 point in the idea of what Bitcoin really was. It was a shift with that adoption curve that came in around then. It was a shift from this is money that can be that is censorship resistant. This is making transactions that you may not be allowed to make. And that moved away from that censorship resistant money to more of an investment profile, and an asset to be invested. And at some point you'll have more fiat money than before, right? When you sell. And I think the bulk of that adoption curve and the adoption curve since then, has been in the investment side of things as what we call like the number go up asset, right?
Yeah.
Whereas the earlier kind of adoption curve was much more ideological in why they were there, because there was no real market price. And when there was a market price, it was still pretty low. And it wasn't about the market price. Right? It was about the freedom involved with this type of thing. So as that occurred, the services and the ecosystem changes, and you end up with, you know, an acceptance and an expectation, really, of KYC and of custodial services and centralized services. So you get, you know, that's what you get.
Well, this has been quite the fascinating chat. Where can people find more about you and what you do, etc.? Obviously, without learning too much about you.
Well, you could, obviously, our website is samuraiwallet.com. SAMOURAI wallet.com, and follow me on Twitter, Samurai Wallet. Recently, we've been uploading videos onto YouTube, and one of the series I'm really proud of is the Bitcoin Privacy series. It's seven videos, each under 7 minutes. So, you know, within I think it's something like 40-45 minutes, if you watch them all back to back, you'll have a seriously improved understanding of not only how Bitcoin appears on the blockchain, but how to start analyzing Bitcoin transactions yourself and the privacy pitfalls that you can try to avoid. It's really easy to follow, and we've been getting a lot of good feedback on that. So for any of your users that want to learn more about Bitcoin privacy, I would say start there. We also, since we talked about Wasabi and this recent event, we also on our YouTube have a 5-minute video where I walk you through exactly visually how they were quote unquote demixed by chain analysis. So if you didn't quite follow along with the audio description on this podcast, go check the video out, because it's much easier to follow that way.
Yeah, well, that sounds fantastic. Thanks very much for sharing your time with me, and hope you have a good one.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and donate to support the show by going to my Cointree page. That's cointr.ee/thedesertlinks, and leave a message with your donation. Check out the show's sponsors. Live on Crypto with BitRefill. Buy absolutely anything with crypto with Shop and Bit. Avoid content censorship with Odyssey. Protect your privacy online with NordVPN. Get paid to search with Presearch. All links are in the show notes.